As this podcast contains themes surrounding Indigenous people, we would like to acknowledge that this podcast was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people, who have been custodians of this land for thousands of years. And we would like to acknowledge and pay our respects to their elders past and emerging. As non-Indigenous individuals, we acknowledge that we are talking about Indigenous themes, but have brought an Indigenous expert into the discussion. Furthermore, we would like to forewarn that this episode contains some distressing themes for Indigenous and non-Indigenous individuals. G'day, policy heads. Welcome back to our fourth episode with Politics vs. Policy with Jared and Sheila. Today we're discussing about Indigenous policy in Australia, a history of failure and finding reconciliation. We are today joined by a fabulous scholar from the University of Melbourne, Dr. Nikki Moody. Hello, Nikki.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us today. So a little bit of a background about Nikki is that she's a Gomeroi woman, born in Gunnedah, New South Wales. She's a senior lecturer in Indigenous Studies at the University of Melbourne. She has received numerous awards for her work, and she's an editor of the Critical Race and Whiteness Studies e-journal and on the editorial board of Health Sociology Review. Nikki holds a Bachelor of Arts with honours in Political Science from the University of Queensland and a PhD in Sociology from the Australian National University. She is currently focusing on social network analysis and Indigenous identity. She's done numerous academic projects in a number of different universities. Nikki was appointed by Professor Ian Anderson as the inaugural University of Melbourne Research Fellow in Indigenous Research and academic convener of the Harmac Indigenous Research Initiative. Nikki has most recently received a four-year ARC Discovery Project from the University of Queensland, focusing on Indigenous governance and Indigenous state relations. Nikki continues to teach in the areas of social policy and Indigenous studies, with her main research interests in indigeneity and governance, focusing on social networks, public policy and data protection.
That is a really long list of achievements. I'm always taken aback about how, like, excellent.
Amazing.
She is.
Yeah.
This makes me sound real flash,
doesn't
it?
Yeah, she does. Well, you're one of the most intelligent people I've probably ever met and a really great influencer on students at the University of Melbourne. So it's fantastic to have you in here, Nikki.
So thank you so much
for coming in. So I just wanted to go on to the game that we've established throughout our policy episodes with our nice guests.
Hit me.
Come on. Okay, so how the game works, Nikki's been told that she has to answer a quick round of questions. She can just basically go for it and we'll take it as it goes. Okay, so first question, Nikki. Australia should break away from the monarchy and become a republic.
Absolutely.
All right. Australia should put a price on carbon, yes or no?
Yes.
Public opinion and media are potent drivers of Indigenous affairs policy. Agree or disagree?
I disagree.
Policy politics in Indigenous affairs attracts a great deal of attention. However, in comparison, the practice, despite its critical importance, does not. True or false?
I think you're absolutely correct. True.
All right. That will probably segue us into what this episode is really about. So we've come to this episode definitely because last week was the release of the 2020 Closing the Gap report, which was delivered by Prime Minister Scott Morrison. It's the 12th since its inception by the Rudd government in 2008, stating Scott Morrison said that things were going better than they were, but we have not made as much progress as we should have. Due to the fact that only 2 out of 7 targets are currently on track to be met, the Prime Minister has called for a new approach with a greater emphasis on government cooperation with Indigenous community involvement going forward. So we wanted to bring Nikki in to have a good discussion about Indigenous policy in Australia in modern age, and she's well-rounded in being an expert in scholarly and academic research, so it'll be a very fantastic discussion, and I'll let Sheila go with the first part.
Yeah, so just setting the scene a little bit, in the book Serious Whitefella Stuff by Professor Mark Moran, Noel Pearson writes that, and I quote, "In Indigenous affairs, there is a good deal of agreement about where we want to get to, i.e. reduced government dependence, the ability for Indigenous people to walk in confidence in two worlds acting as active participants in the prosperous economic and social life of the nation, and as members of living vibrant Indigenous cultures. But while there is agreement on this destination, there is far less agreement on how we are to get there. So would you explain to us just how the current outlook of Indigenous policy in Australia right now is?
Well, it's not great, is it? Let's be honest. I think we can take statements like that and we can see embedded in it a really passionate desire for improvement. Right, there is widespread recognition that things are not okay and they haven't been okay since the very founding of the nation. And how we go about understanding that foundation and its impacts today really has significant impacts on what we think we should do. But I'm not entirely sure if I wholly agree with Mr. Pearson on a number of these points. I think that there is less agreement on the desired destination, less agreement on what Indigenous political organisation should look like in Australia, questions of representation. What does the nature of invasion, frontier wars, genocide and the conflict that sits at the heart of the creation of our nation, what are the implications for that, for how we imagine First Nations people as an integral part of the foundation and the continuance and the development of our democracy? What does that mean for what we do going forward? I think probably conversely has much more agreement on it, particularly in scholarly circles, than Pearson and perhaps Moran might suggest. You know, there's a couple of things going on here. How do we think of conflict? How do we think about representation? And what is the best relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples in Australia as political organisations, as polities, as peoples, and, you know, as a nation, as part of Australia? You know, these are really integral questions that are not just about Indigenous people or Indigenous well-being. They're actually about everyone. They're about how we imagine what it means to be in Australia, to be Australian, to be part of the type of democracy that we have here. And these are really fundamental questions. And they sound really overwhelming, right? It's like, oh my God. We were talking about closing the gap. Now it's like democracy.
Yeah.
Oh my God. But, you know, Indigenous peoples had the answers to our own well-being and our own political representation and our own solutions to our own problems for like a really long time, like proper long time, like 60,000 years long time, right? And that hasn't changed in the past 200. So when we think about the current outlook of Indigenous policy, I think it's really important that we start to train ourselves to listen to what Indigenous people say, because the actual policy process is quite messy. Politics is quite messy, right?
That's been a very consistent theme of our podcast discussions.
That's
very
so
much so. With what you referenced before with the founding of a nation, I would love just to, for our listeners as well, just to come to the history side of government policy and Indigenous Australians and kind of get to the crux of the invasion of Australia by white settlers and how governments from there, either they be colonial, state or federal, have worked within the area of Indigenous affairs. So I would just like to ask maybe one question of how the invasion of Australia could, in comparison, be different to the countries who came before, such as New Zealand or the Americas, in terms of Indigenous affairs?
It's such a radically different kind of political and economic context in all of those different places, right? Mm. In New Zealand, Maori peoples have kind of like one language with many different dialects, and that affected their political representations. In North America, the United States of America has 380, in excess of 380 separate treaties with Native American peoples, right? In Canada, there was a process of treaty making. So Australia, you know, really is quite aberrant in the context of the Kansas states, particularly, because there was never this kind of treaty making process. And that comes down to a whole range of different things, right? You know, settlement and invasion occurred in different ways in different times in Australia. So here I have the creation of the East Coast penal colonies and the military front that proceeded out of what we now know as Sydney. In Melbourne, Naam was originally kind of invaded via Tasmania as a commercial enterprise by the Port Phillip Association, right? And so you kind of have this incredible complexity in the pattern of European invasion of Australia. The English weren't the first people here. There was the Dutch on the west coast. You've got a kind of a mapping history in the north of Australia. You know, it's such a complex history, and it includes things which people are often quite ashamed of, or which are quite confronting, and which are very traumatic for Aboriginal people. But somehow it's easier for us to talk about histories of violent conflict or warfare and frontier violence in other parts of the world. It's easier in Australia for us to talk about what happened in East Timor. It's easier for us to talk about what happened in Rwanda or what happened in World War II with the Holocaust. We can reconcile ourselves to political conflicts and violence when we're talking about it in other places. But as soon as we start to talk about it in Australia, we start to get hard up against all of these different types of narratives that we like to tell ourselves. We try to, these kinds of ideas of character building and nationalism and how we understand who we are and what we stand for. And it's, I think, part of a maturing as a nation. I think it's part of understanding our place in the world, in Asia, in the Pacific. I think it's part of all sorts of complex things which don't always serve dominant political narratives in Australia to start talking about, right? And so, you know, I desperately want to be able to give you like a simple answer on history or a simple answer on how do we understand invasion, frontier warfare, conflict and violence. But I think the first step, you know, when I'm talking to students is often about, you know, even just kind of bringing that to an awareness. What is it about distance or nationalism or time that means that we can think about these things in other places, but we have such difficulty thinking about it here? I think it's a really important question.
I've just got probably two off the fly questions relating to that. The first being about how do you believe the national curriculum has, in terms of education, has gone about in missing a whole part of Indigenous history for young Australians, where I grew up in Northern Territory, in Alice Springs. I went to a school where we still had no real relevant education on Indigenous history, but from what I could see on the outside, I was gaining a lot more information about the hurt and the sadness within the communities about their history around the area. What would be your response to how Australia could work to make a better curriculum surrounding Indigenous history itself, not just for students, but possibly people around?
I think it's really important that we support teachers and other types of education workers to make sure that they feel like they have a foundation of knowledge. So it's actually quite challenging, I think, for many people who've been through precisely the same education system that you have to suddenly turn around and start teaching this kind of complex history, right? I think that we really need to support people through professional learning, through opportunities for development, through creating communities of learning and practice to be able to tackle some of these complex issues, right? But at a really foundational level, I think we need to think about what the education system is actually for. So all institutions in Australia are colonial institutions, right? All of them. Mm-hmm. The education system, the banking system, a legal system.
Government system.
Government systems are white, right? Mm. Okay, so what do we expect white colonial institutions to do? We expect them to reproduce white colonial institutions. Mm. And so we look at schools and we're like, hang on a second, I think I was ripped off.
Yeah.
I think I was sold a narrative about white supremacy and the natural inevitability of white colonial institutions. Mm. Sounds like a crock, doesn't it? You know, but this institution is doing exactly what this institution is designed to do, right? Yeah. Designed to support, inculcate, train, discipline, enable people to function in a particular type of system. And if we turn around and we say to that system, hang on a second, you're not teaching us about our full history. You're not teaching Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander kids what they need to know to be strong and fluent in their own languages and cultures. And I'm like, hang on a second, that's not what those institutions were ever set up to do. And we turn around and suddenly we spend an awful lot of time trying to fix those institutions as opposed to thinking about what do Indigenous institutions look like? Mm. What do Indigenous schools need to have to do precisely those same things to train, to discipline, to inculcate, to support Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students to thrive in our own cultures and with our own languages, right? And so I think sometimes we misrecognise the origin of an institution, its purpose, and the possibility of institutions looking like something else.
And just before we head back to the historical context, I want to ask one question. It's probably going to be a hot-button issue. We've just recently come out of January where we have the 26th of January, which is Australia Day, and some have labelled it recently as Invasion Day, in which
I don't know if that's a recent thing.
Well, no, definitely not a recent thing, but like it's gained a lot more traction in recent years.
It has.
And my personal belief is, yes, I also label it Invasion Day. But when we come to discussion around the day, how do you believe a constructive conversation can be had with those who believe that it's not an Invasion Day kind of vibe? If you
let me see if I can kind of, because you're right, it's complex, and trying complex. To develop a vocabulary to talk about these things is really hard, right? Because everything to do with Indigenous affairs has been so suppressed and erased for so long that even trying to have a conversation about these issues is just really challenging. So if I could kind of, like, I think pull apart the parts of your question,
yeah,
right?
If my question came back to make sense. Yeah.
So what I think you've kind of first pointed to is whether or not we can talk about invasion.
Yeah.
Can we say that Australia was invaded? Yes, absolutely, yes. Of course. There was no recognition of sovereign peoples existing prior. There's numerous extensive works done on the legal basis by which the British could invade other people, and Australia doesn't meet the goddamn criteria. You know what I mean? So, look, I think we can put that to the side, and I think it's really important that we don't feed into these are really old narratives about history wars and culture wars, and they're really distracting, right? They don't actually let us get to the important issues. So I think we have to look at the established scholarly historical facts of the matter. Was there an invasion? Yes, of course. Secondly, what does it mean to be celebrating the foundation of a modern nation state on that particular day?
Yeah.
To recognise that there were hundreds of independent sovereign nations in Australia at 1788 with established functioning systems of law and economies and trading routes and religions and languages, they're all distinct from each other. And to then say that those peoples have no right to have a say about what it means for other people to have a holiday on that day, to celebrate that day, I think is a misrecognition of what the foundational scar is, I guess, at the heart of the creation of the nation. And to then say, well, is there a day that we could all come together to celebrate the journey that we've been on as a nation, to look towards the future, to think about how we might imagine ourselves as something different? Of course, there are so many days. There are so many days. There's a day that we had a prime minister tell Churchill to piss off and that we'll have our troops back. Thanks very much. We're not going to send our men to die in Europe.
Yeah.
There's the day we invented Wi-Fi. You know, there's the day we gave women to vote. There's Apology Day. You know what I mean? There are many more days that we can think about what it means to be a mature nation in the world in the 21st century that isn't afraid or embarrassed or ashamed of the things that have happened in the past. It isn't trying to cover it up. That's trying to say that we're a complex polity that has a place for Indigenous peoples, that has a place for Anglo-European settler invaders, that has a place for new Australians, that has a place for people who want to come here and make a life. And we can do that together. And the idea that we have to celebrate that on January 26th, I think, is kind of doesn't make a lot of sense when you put it in that kind of context, I think. At least that's the way that I try and understand it anyway.
It relates back to, if I could come back to how you mentioned about the institutions in Australia being quote-unquote white. With that perspective, do you reckon that Indigenous policies in Australia can ever make it right if there is no institutional reform?
I think that there must be, as there is in other settler colonial states, there must be a reimagination of what that relationship is between Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people. At a foundational level, the state has to be able to engage with Indigenous nations as equals. And that's part of the problem of, like, the embedded racism, of the whiteness, of the coloniality, of the settler colonialism, is that Indigenous peoples, our political organisations, our ways of living and being, religion, societies, economies, structures at 1788 were never seen as sufficiently sophisticated to entreat with the state on an equal footing. And until states are able to engage with Indigenous peoples as a state-to-state relationship, as a nation-to-nation relationship, then all Indigenous policy will be in the service of the aims of the state. Mm. And to serve the aims of the state is kind of one thing if you think of states as liberal, democratic, benevolent entities that are trying to do the best thing for all its people. But I think that there are some concerns that Western democracies are not kind of doing that anymore, if they ever have, particularly for Indigenous people. So I think that what does it mean to think about the nation of Australia to engage with the Wiradjuri Nation or the Gomeroi Nation or the Yolngu Nation or any other nation of Indigenous peoples constituted as a political entity? And if the state can wrap its head around that kind of policy, devolve decision-making power, fund accordingly, and support Indigenous peoples to negotiate on an equal footing with the state, then I think we might get somewhere.
It's back to the history of Indigenous policy. I kind of want to bring it to probably, and it really is for a lot of Indigenous Australians as well as Australians who within the academic area, the era of assimilation, which involved the Aboriginal Protection Act, which caused, I cannot put the words really to what
we can
it
use it as shorthand for profound intergenerational trauma.
Basically that is, that is without a doubt. And I just want to ask you to explain that period and how that is. You've already touched on frontier wars and the invasion by white settlers and how we as Australians don't really have that history taught to us. But the one thing that I found that I did learn in school was about the Stolen Generations, and it was very, very important. But a lot of Australians today, I believe, need to understand that along with the frontier wars, that the Stolen Generations caused basically an emotional supercharge for how we've come to where we are in Indigenous policy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
And are you able to kind of touch on, for our listeners who might not understand Stolen Generations as well as someone in the field, just what it did and how it caused us to be where we are in Indigenous policy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the first thing that I want to do is just say to any listeners that when we're talking about issues like child removal, it can bring up a lot of trauma for a whole range of different people. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, forced adoptions are unfortunately, a really common part of often colonial history, you know, outside of the context of Indigenous peoples, you know, young mums having their children taken away from them in hospitals, you know. These are the kinds of state behaviours that governments will often do in order to control aberrant populations, in order to manage undesirables, right? Because if a government can point to quote-unquote loose women or the poor people and manage their children, then it enables a whole other type of surveillance and governmentality around what a government can do. And so I just want to acknowledge that it can bring up a lot of hurt and trauma for a lot of different people. In the context of Indigenous affairs, though, child removal fits actually very clearly one of the definitions of genocide as defined by the United Nations. And there are five different types of ways that that the United Nations recognises that genocide can occur, and removing the children of a generation is one of them, because you in effect create a massive disjuncture between not just one generation and the next, but one generation and all their subsequent generations. So all of the knowledge that parents and grandparents hold around the language that you speak, around your religion and your belief system, around how you know the world, has an immediate and often permanent disjuncture. Children are raised not being able to speak their language. They don't know who they are or where they come from. And the implications of that ripple down through generations. And we know that people who are members of the stolen generations, you know, often really struggle with their health, to form relationships with people that are safe and supportive, because those basic foundational relationships that we all need at the very beginning of our life, we all need, you know, parents who love us and a family to orient us in the world. And when that's gone, you know, how do we know who we are and what to do with our lives? There was some research that was done a little while ago that says that, like, the most protective thing that you can do, particularly if you're a guy, is to get married. For your health,
really?
The best thing for you to do,
okay.
Absolutely, the like literally, I think it's only after like quitting smoking, like by getting married, I think it's like even more protective than that, right? So being married has a range of protective factors, particularly for men. It doesn't necessarily apply to other people, right? So because it enables a whole range of other social things, right? You have someone often, if you maintain traditional gender roles, that kind of takes care of you. And being a member of the stolen generations, the impact on your psychosocial health is so severe that often the protective effects of an institution like marriage can't always heal those traumas. So even things that we know are really important social institutions that protect people and create a community around you aren't always enough to make up for that profound separation and trauma that's occurred right at the beginning of life. The implications, I think, of the stolen generations are going to be with us for so long into the future, particularly because now what we're seeing is a rate of child removal in Indigenous communities that is now higher than it ever was during the assimilation era. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children today are being taken away from their parents at rates that far exceed any of the period between 1910 to 1960. What we're seeing is absolutely another stolen generation, if not stolen generations, plural. And so these kinds of processes of dislocation, the implications of that for people's health and well-being, the implications of that for culture and language and community are incredible. They're so profound. And we have the New South Wales government passing forced adoption legislation to make sure that kids in foster care can't go back to their communities. You know, so there's a huge problem here that we think that these things are, we think that they're relics of the past. When we don't understand the implications of what we did in the past, let alone to understand what's actually happening now in front of us. We like to think that we've kind of moved on, that we resolved, that we apologize, that these things are somehow healed, and they couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, that's going back to what I said before about being a kid, is that when you did learn about Indigenous affairs in a school curriculum, they showed it in a way that we did that. We took children. But we don't do that anymore, and it didn't really have that major effect, because basically, if I have to be really honest, they just showed us a movie, which is called The Rabbit Proof Fence, which is a very emotional a movie, and it's a fantastic movie. But
such an important film.
And it's without a doubt, I would have to plug it. I would rate it highly as one of my most favourite films of all time, and fantastic Australian cinema. But I'm digressing with the fact that basically I felt, and I feel it now, that I've been very lucky to obtain a lot more information, that they just showed me that film and was like, this is a snippet of Australian history.
This is what happened in the past.
Yeah.
We've moved on. Wasn't that awful?
Yeah. Our bad. And I'm like, no, because that's created on top of frontier warfare and death of many Indigenous Australians during invasion. The psychology of Indigenous Australians and their children is going to be impacted for so, so long. So to hear you say that is fantastic, that my mind and people who think that way are like, that's justified to think that way.
Yeah, it is. It is absolutely. And if I can potentially be a little crude.
Go for it.
If I may, I think when it comes to things that might be broadly accepted out there in the world about Indigenous stuff, it is really important to, you know, have your bullshit detector on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there are a lot of publicly accepted narratives. There is a lot of public discourse around what is good, accepted, normal, obvious in Indigenous affairs. And the only way I think that we can begin to short circuit that is to begin to train people to listen to what Aboriginal people are saying. Just in the first instance, just what do Aboriginal people say, you know? And that begins to help people to realise that the things that Indigenous people say about Indigenous affairs is the first and only point of call here, you know? Like, there was an old saying from, I think it came out of the disability rights movement, that says nothing about us without us.
Mm.
And in Indigenous affairs, things have been done to us and about us for a very long time. And it's about time, I think, that the tables were turned.
Moving on from that period, we moved into a period that is labelled by scholarly and academics as the era of self-determination, because that is going to bridge us into where we are now. And I would like, if it's possible for you, just to kind of give us a little bit more context to what that did and how that was good for Indigenous people, but it didn't still give them things that they needed.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think the first point is to kind of get really clear about what we mean when we say self-determination.
Mm.
And in many senses, it does what it says on the box, right? Do you have the authority, the political power to determine your own futures? If you have a look at the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, that has got like self-determination all the way through it. Self-determination in education, self-determination in politics, self-determination for economic futures. It's all there, right? And in many ways, again, other states in the Kansas grouping have implemented actual self-determination, in some cases for hundreds of years. There have been Maori seats in parliament. There are self-governing tribal nations in North America. Self-determination in other parts of the world actually happens for Indigenous people. But in Australia, it has always been subject to the whims of the state. So that's where we get statutory bodies like the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Commission, ATSIC. It was abolished in 96, but I could be wrong on the date. And no doubt a kind listener will correct me on that. But to think about what self-determination means in an Australian context has always been within the existing constitutional and legal structures that we have in the state. So within this set of white colonial institutions, Indigenous peoples have had some limited authority to be able to design programs, spend some money, engage in some community development. And that's kind of it. The idea of self-determination in its truest sense is probably something much more stronger than that, that might be akin to more like self-governance or self-government, where Indigenous peoples have political groupings that have the authority to be able to determine a whole range of different state-like functions for the Indigenous peoples who were members of that political grouping. Does that kind of make sense? So,
yep.
So self-determination in Australia as a kind of a policy phase was moderately kind of effective, right? We had ATSIC, there are some institutions, there was some Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation. It looked like some progress was being made. But until various sectors of the economy start to consider, you know, the mining industry, what happens with an Aboriginal land base, that's when we start to see the rubber really hit the road. So a hawk's walking back of self-determination policy in the late 80s and early 90s, the response of the Howard Fisher government to WIC and the 10-point plan in response to the Native Title Act. And again, we see, you know, resistance to constitutional recognition for Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people today. So it's this kind of complex mess of who's got interest in Aboriginal land, how much compensation are people entitled to, what's a land base, what's a political structure. And so real self-determination, I think, is easier to see in other settler colonial states with Indigenous populations than it is often with Australia.
Into the 2000s and now, we're probably going to touch on another controversial subject in terms of the Howard government and what has been labelled the Northern Territory intervention. And that was something that was highly talked about around the time that it occurred. And I seem to remember it predominantly. It wasn't really in my area where operations were rolled out, but still it had a profound impact on how we viewed Indigenous policy was going forward. And I would like just for you to elaborate on the, it's a quite a controversial moment in Indigenous policy because there, at times there were possibly people for it and people against it, and opinions have swayed in the time since. But just to give us a real idea of what it was truly about and the impacts that it had on policy, where do you believe, how do you believe that question can be answered?
I'm going to do something that might be a little bit controversial here, and I'm going to kind of take a step to the side because every international review of the Northern Territory intervention, nearly every single scholarly paper that I've ever read on the intervention roundly condemns it as a gross violation of human rights. Mm. It's that simple. The step that I'm going to take to the side is to encourage you to think of the purpose that Indigenous affairs plays in the national political landscape. So I want you, if you can, to bear with me for a second, and I want you to hold to the side the content of the intervention, the harm that it did, the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act, how it portrayed Aboriginal men. I just want you for a second to see if you can hold that to the side, and I want you to think about why did John Howard do that in the 12 days in between the release of the Little Children of Sacred Report and the start of the Northern Territory intervention? Why would John Howard represent that as a national emergency? And in my particularly cynical opinion, it's because Indigenous affairs in Australia are only ever used as wedge politics. The idea that Indigenous affairs in Australia is designed for Aboriginal people is one of the biggest lies that has ever been told to the Australian electorate. The only purpose that the Northern Territory intervention served was John Howard's attempt to wedge the election ahead of the 2007 Kevin Rudd win. And it nearly succeeded. And the fact that successive governments have kept it, rebadged it, rolled it over, tells you everything you need to know about the way that the Australian government views Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in this country. To think about what do white people think of the Northern Territory intervention? How will white people react to the Northern Territory intervention as an electoral strategy? Will give you much more interesting answers than trawling through the profound harm and damage that that did and still does to Aboriginal people across the whole country. Indigenous people are routinely used as political experiments. As you can see from the basics cards, from welfare quarantining, they try it out on Aboriginal people, then they roll it out to everyone else. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in this country serve a purpose, and they serve a purpose for white politicians who either need to wedge the electorate on issues or they want to try increasingly aggressive surveillance measures, and it is reprehensible.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Before we were talking to you, I was talking to Jared as well, reading out all the things that we wrote, that we read. I can't seem to find any tangible objective of the policies. And it made me wonder if all these are just ethical and rhetoric rather than we have actually purpose of doing all these for the Indigenous people.
Absolutely. I think that that's an incredibly insightful question to be asking. And I think it gets much more, I think that gets much more closer to the heart of Australian politics than anything else, right? When we talk about how does politics work in Australia, we often look to policies because we're such an incredibly rule-bound country, right? We're so obsessed with like looking, did the policy achieve its stated aims? Have we got an evaluation on that policy? Where did that policy come from? Let's have a look at the policy window and see how that emerged. Right? What is policy? What is policy? It's another word for politics. It's the implementation of a political agenda. And what is politics but power? And so what does it mean to have power over Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as opposed to recognise other systems that might coexist alongside an equitable distribution of power to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people for power over our own lives? Nothing more. Nothing more than that. Not seeking to have power over anyone else's lives. Only self-determination over our own languages and communities and well-being. Michael Mansell, who for a long time has advocated for a seventh state of Australia that's only Aboriginal, right? But we have to entertain these ideas. We have to be, I think, enlivened by the possibilities, by listening to the diversity of Indigenous views on these issues. Because it's only by hearing others, genuinely hearing others, that we're able to actually get a more accurate picture of how our societies actually function, right? Otherwise, we're just living in a white bubble of whiteness.
Yeah. No diversity whatsoever.
Oh, it looks dull. It's dull, it's boring, it's violent. It doesn't do anyone any favours.
So I know we probably need to move on, but there's one last area that I want to touch on, the history of Indigenous policy in Australia. And it's quite relevant, and it's where I believe the jumping off point to where we are right now with the win of Kevin Rudd in 2007. Kevin Rudd's apology to all the Indigenous people in 2008, he basically made an apology on behalf of the Australian Parliament to all Indigenous Australians and Torres Strait Islanders, in particular Stolen Generations. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to talk about with you was, do you believe this was a considerable step forward for the government and Indigenous people relations, or how do you believe it impacted policy going forward in this in a future where we harness the determination of all Australians, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, to close the gap?
The first thing that I want to say is that symbols are important in any polity, right? So this idea that the apology was tokenistic, or that people are worried about token gestures, I think we really kind of need to put that to bed, because symbols are important, they have power, and an apology is a particularly important symbol to recognise the harms of the past and to symbolise that the government hasn't in some way acknowledged the harm that previous Australian governments did. Mm. Right. So I think that was important. It meant a lot to a lot of people to hear that.
Yeah, I remember
coming from the Prime Minister.
It's 2020, so I was about 12 years old when I was glued to the TV screen watching that, and I just thought it was fundamentally necessary. Even as a 12-year-old, I don't know particularly why, but I felt a great sense of emotion, and I can't comprehend what emotion that meant for Indigenous Australians all across Australia. I know that sounds very...
No, I imagine it would have been really emotional, actually. Yeah.
I know that sounds like really like, come on, Jared.
Jared, I think what you've done is you've highlighted something that I don't think we talk about in politics very often, and that is the role of public emotion. I think that's really important for us to think about, especially when we're often, you know, so individualized in our public responses. We think that we can only exercise, you know, political power or authority potentially on social media, but really only in the ballot box, right? You know, so these kinds of civic engagement, the kinds of actions that we think we can do to affect political change, we often imagine them as really quite limited as citizens, right? But I think if we start talking about the role that emotion plays, we suddenly start to open up a whole range of different things, especially when we're talking about complicated histories, talking about histories of trauma in other countries. We're talking about profoundly violent histories of torture and warfare, and how we understand ourselves as a political organisation that can face those, can see them, and can think about justice, can think about reparations, can think about what does it mean to consider actions that we take against perpetrators of these kinds of actions. How do we think about how do we support people who were victims of these kinds of profoundly violent institutional responses? You know, are really important questions for a society that I don't think we can describe as post-conflict, right? Mm. I think this conflict is very much alive. But what an apology does without being supplemented by a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, by prosecutions, by any of the normal mechanisms that we would usually see as justice to be visited, what an apology on its own does, I think, is just kind of makes everyone feel better.
Mm.
And it firmly squares off something that happened in the past and absolves us to move into a new, lighter, brighter, whiter future together, right? Mm. And so the public discourse about the apology, I think, is very separate from the work that an apology does for a government,
mm.
right? And so there's no conversation about reparations, yeah? There's no conversation about, are we going to prosecute people who made these decisions? There's none of that conversation. It's an apology, and we've moved on. And I think that we can hold those two things separate. We can say that it was important and good and right to do, and then we can think of the so what then. What possibilities does an apology close off? What does it open up? What does it enable? What does it let us talk about, and what does it not let us talk about now that this apology has happened? And I think that we can see that conversations about historical violence and historical trauma have largely been publicly resolved by an apology. It's seen as a good thing. We did it. We can all move on. And I think that that actually doesn't serve Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that well. And as I think you can probably pretty much see it, nearly any protest that you go to, you know, a banner that says saying sorry means you don't do it again, right? And so the idea that that has made invisible ongoing state violence against Aboriginal people, I think, is really problematic.
Thank you so much for that fantastic insight to the historical complexities of Indigenous affairs. We will end part one of the episode there, because I believe we need to definitely go in depth about contemporary policies initiated by the governments, and I believe that that can't be shortened into or shoehorned to an end of an episode. So we're going to end this episode here, and please tune in to part two of this podcast, because it's just a fundamentally great conversation that we're having at the moment, and
absolutely,
Nikki's very much enlightening us. So we'll see you in the next episode.
See ya.